Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Pod Network Entertainment.
In during the pandemic was launching the very first online community fabric store. So we're the first online store in the Philippines that sells Filipino textiles. And it was amazing. It really gave such a huge sense of ownership among the artisans. They were so proud to see their beautiful fabrics on a website. And it worked. Like, a lot of the diaspora community in the US, in Australia, in the UK, we're now buying fabrics because it's accessible and they're transforming it into different things.
And good evening, good afternoon, good morning to wherever you're watching or listening to this podcast from here in the Philippines and from all over the world. And welcome to my podcast, the RJ Ledesma Podcast. Now, in this podcast, I love actually speaking to pioneering, trailblazing entrepreneurs from the Philippines, and of course, from all over the world, the Philippine diaspora, to learn more about their success secrets when it comes to businesses. Can we replicate those success secrets? How do they think about doing business? And more importantly, what business opportunities do they see emerging in this new normal scenario? Now, do you know anybody whom you would like me to feature here on this program because they're great entrepreneurs as well or business people? Please let me know. I would love to learn from them. At the same time, you're also live right now on YouTube. Now, tonight's guest is another Ramon V. Del Rosario 2023 SICLAB awardee. We're very happy to have her over here, especially because of the efforts that she's doing for our indigenous communities when it comes to fashion. We have here right now the visionary leader of Anthill. Anthill stands for Alternative Nest and Training Hub for Indigenous Little Livelihood Seekers. So that's Anthill. And this enterprise was born out of a deep commitment to address the prevalent issues of poverty and unemployment faced by the marginalized sectors, particularly amongst our indigenous community. This was put together by Joy Anya Lim, who is listening, who's joining us all the way from Cebu. Joy, welcome to the program. Welcome to the RJ Ledesma Podcast.
Hello, thanks for having us, RJ, and giving us a platform to share our story.
So great to have you. Maayong gabi sa inyo tanan.
Maayong gabi, yes, indeed.
Thanks for so much for joining us. So let's get straight into it. Can you help me better appreciate, Lam, what is Anthill all about in a nutshell? I mean, I talked about it. It's a bit complicated, but usually like what they say when you go to a startup and you make a pitch, they say, what's the most basic pitch for people to understand what Anthill is all about?
Yeah, basically, we are a social and a cultural enterprise with a mission to provide sustainable livelihood to our craft artisans. And we do this by applying our weaves, our Philippine textiles, into contemporary and circular design, like what we're doing. And also by building their entrepreneurial capacity so they can run their businesses independently and become self-reliant.
Got that. So I guess what you're wearing right now, from the necklace to the outfit, are those all from Anthill? Wow, yes.
Yeah, so this one represents circularity. So these are scraps, mga retaso. And this is a design by Tropique Bitnik. And then this one is a contemporary terno.
Okay, sorry. For those who are approaching the term the first time, what do you mean by circularity when it comes to your necklace?
Yeah, so circularity is a movement or a practice wherein we extend the life cycle of the product. So instead of like the textiles going to a dump site and becoming waste and contributing to pollution, we extend the product life cycle and up upgrade it, like elevate the value of it. So we upcycle it. So this could have just been, you know, pieces of offcuts and end cuts, but now it's like a pretty earring, you know, that you can wear.
Got that. And then for the dress in particular, is there anything upcycled about it or sustainable about it? Or it's because it's also something that is from indigenous community?
So apart from it being a pattern that's indigenous to Itneg communities or the Abra community, they also use discarded thread. So these big thread manufacturers like Monaco and Apple, they discard or they just throw away thread that they can't anymore use. And then our artisans, our community, they buy this thread per kilo, and that's what they use as input material in the textiles.
And also very recently, I mean, you've been around since 2010, but just this year, you won in the RBR or Ramon B. Del Rosario Siklab Awards. What exactly is the award, and why do you feel for yourself it's such an achievement for you? I mean, of course, it's a great award, right? So all awards are, you know, feel really great, but in this particular, this one, why does it resonate with you, this award?
Yeah, well, it's, well, personally, because Ramon V. Del Rosario is, like, I think, is the epitome and lives the essence of leadership and entrepreneurship, but particularly around impact entrepreneurship and innovation. And that's our shared value. We use our platform, our business, our enterprise to contribute to nation building. And we're also in our values, we're very committed to impact. And we do that by innovating a lot of things within the business. To me personally, it was such an honor because I was the only woman awardee, and it's good it's good to be able to recognize the power of women and economic empowerment. And there's a lot of women out there investing in providing economic opportunities to other women. And also, we know for a fact that when you invest in women, there's a multiplier effect to their families and to the communities. And personally, I think coming from the pandemic, it was such a good validation for us. And it reignited the Siklab in us also. It fueled kind of our passion, you know, to be committed to our purpose and to stay and endure the course of our business journey.
Yeah, I can really relate to you saying how sometimes the pandemic either validates or strengthens if you believe that there's a higher purpose to the business which you are doing. Like, just to share with you the example of my own business together with my wife, Vanessa, for Mercato Central. You know, we're an outdoor food market and we had to close everything down, right? So that meant that, you know, if we had no other purpose than just to run a food market, then you know, that's it. Let's look for another business. But the higher purpose for us was to say, there are people whose livelihoods depend on us being able to operate a market which allows for small food entrepreneurs to grow. And that's, we try to find different ways and means to reignite the business, to reestablish the business. And you discover, I guess, new business models as it comes around. And I just wanted to share one more thing with you, which I found very important for me, is that it's also very important for me to focus on women entrepreneurs, because like for myself, I have a daughter who's 14 years old, and I always want to make sure that, you know, her mom is a role model for her because her mom is a strong entrepreneur. But I wanted to see that there are so many strong female entrepreneurs who can change the world by what they're doing. So very happy to have you here on the program. And just to unpack a bit, you know, there's a lot that you said, no? Like, I have to unpack a lot about impact entrepreneurs and impact investors. There's a lot of terminologies that some people are encountering for the first time over here. And I guess that's due to the fact that what you are is what we call a social enterprise, right? And much of what we've had here on the show are startups. And when people understand that startups are being sort of businesses which are able to scale through the help of technology, right? But at the same time, as they scale, they're able to get a lot of what we call venture capitalists to invest in the company to scale very fast. And that, I mean, that's putting it in, that's simplifying it a bit too much, no? But that's basically it. These are tech startups, right? But then you are a social enterprise, and maybe people are still sort of struggling with what a social enterprise means. Can you help break it down for us? What would be the primary difference between what is a startup, I guess, and what is a social enterprise?
Yes. So a social enterprise is like any other business, but the difference is it uses business strategies to address a social issue. So I think when I explain it to people, there's always three elements to a social enterprise that kind of sets it apart from a traditional business or a startup. So one is, Our core mission actually revolves around providing a solution to a social problem. So, and second is it has to be impact driven, right? So we have to be very clear about how are we going to use business strategies, innovations, creativity to actually address and help solve this social issue and create positive impact. Number three, social enterprises have to be very committed to sustainability. You know, we have to be able to look at how we're able to access responsible profit, because like any other business, we have to be able to be profitable so we can reinvest our profits in addressing the social issue. And then lastly, social enterprises are known to be very creative and innovative because it's an alternative form of business. It's not the traditional way of doing business. And so you have to find means on how you can achieve your metrics, impact metrics, and also your business metrics at the same time. But on top of being a social enterprise, Anthill is also a cultural enterprise. So we're very sensitive and we look at how culture is elevated, how culture is consumed, and how culture is produced within the context of weaving.
Wow. Then as you keep on talking to me, a lot of questions spring to mind. And I think it's very important that we're able to ask these questions. That, well, first of all, in your own background, did you ever explore? Can I ask what your background is, first of all? Is it entrepreneurship, or were you into fashion, or were you into social work? Can you help me understand better what informed your decision to put together Anthill?
Thank you. No, my undergrad was in advertising and economics, but I'm not into fashion. I'm not a fashion designer. That's always a misconception. And it may seem like Anthill is a fashion brand, but really at the core of our work is community building and community development. I had a very short stint in corporate. I used to work for Unilever, but then it wasn't for me, and I readily jumped on into the development sector. So I used to do fundraising and resource mobilization and advocacy communications. And I think that's really what got me into thinking about, social change, how I can create social change. But my family, my parents are both in the textile business. So I grew up around fashion. And my mom also is a volunteer. Like, she used to do a lot of volunteer work in her university days. And so I grew up with that kind of values and upbringing. And I was very much immersed in the way she worked and the way she also was very much immersed in indigenous communities. So I was very drawn to understanding our indigenous communities. I was very drawn to understanding our weaving culture. And at a very young age, my parents would take us to visit these weaving villages. So I think that's where I first experienced or saw firsthand the problem that existed in our weaving communities, being that it was only among elders, like puros matatanda na yung nagahabi, walang younger generation who are wanting to learn the craft. And so there was a gap in cultural continuity. There was a gap there was a challenge or a barrier in ensuring that the craft is passed on to the younger generation.
And as you tell me this one, it just makes me very curious. And I hope you don't mind. I don't mean to sound like I'm saying it's stereotypical, but usually, I mean, you're Filipino Chinese, so usually
yes.
The assumption is a textile business. So usually the assumption is that the business has to be profitable. I mean, you know, it doesn't profit first before. I mean,
yeah,
the profit muna, but then it seems to me that your parents were able to help you see, particularly your mom was able to help you see other alternatives to just merely, you know, relying on the textile business and seeing it purely as a profit play. Am I right?
I've never actually shared this in public, but yeah. So obviously, my parents being Filipino Chinese expected me to take over the family business. And, you know, in the past, we would be compelled to like spend summer and working at the store to just understand how it goes. Common story.
On that too, I've also been Filipino Chinese. I mean, it's very same experience.
Yeah.
And it comes to springboard, but to start up. But yours is a springboard to social enterprise. For me, it's a bit, you know, it's a bit refreshing and also a bit different.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of my mom's doing. But, you know, as co-founder, so my mom was co-founder. And because I guess she was able to build her life around a traditional business, when I started Ant Hill, with her encouragement, there was still a struggle in terms of how do we operate the business. Because when we started Ant Hill, I was very, very keen and very focused on making sure that we build the capacity of the community first. And we focus on the program we were running in the communities. Whereas my mom was saying, dapat kumikita ka na. You have to be profitable. You have to have inventory. You can't just focus so much of your time and energy in the program. So actually, my mom and I had a lot of arguments. And it took a while for me to, I guess, understand the value of profit in a responsible manner. I was very reluctant, or I had a different relationship then with money or profit, given that I came from a development background.
That's right. And that's another question that actually, I hope you don't mind it, because
go ahead.
Each other. The idea is that actually profitability in a social enterprise, because for me, with some trepidation, diba, I'm trained also professionally, right? So to do a business, really sure it's profitable. But you're worried about sometimes social enterprise because it's saying like, oh, you shouldn't be making really a profit because it's a social enterprise, or your profit should be capped at a certain rate lang because it's a social enterprise. Is that how to correctly understand profitability at social enterprise? What is it to you guys? Yeah. It's a bit exciting here right now because as we await, as she answers that question, I think there's a challenge with the internet coming from Cebu. So it's going to come back in just a bit. And again, we're listening here right now to Joy Anyalim all the way from Cebu with regard to Ant Hill, which is her social enterprise. It stands for Alternative Nest and Training Hub for Indigenous Little Livelihood Seekers. That's Ant Hill. And like she was saying, she came from the first corporate and went into the development sector after that one. Just to let you know, Anyalim recognized the inherent value of weaving and the craft industry providing sustainable livelihoods for the indigenous people. However, because of the lack of market access, production capacity, and the demand, there was very low profitability. And so many people are forced to go to the city. So many people, they actually lose the craft in the process because they all go to the city. As a result of that one, it sort of crystallized what Ant Hill was supposed to do and what its mission was supposed to be. And the mission of Ant Hill was to be able to harness this untapped potential of these undervalued weaving and craft skills. So let's keep them, of course, in their provinces. And more importantly, as we keep them in the provinces, we try to create sustainable livelihoods for them. But at the same time, and more importantly, like she was saying, part of the measure of the success of their business is cultural metrics. And one of the best ways to preserve cultural metrics is to preserve the rich traditions and craft processes of these different indigenous communities. Ayan. So again, let's welcome back Anya over here. So Anya,
sorry, I got disconnected. Yeah.
No worries. We want to go back again to ask you about, you know, what's the relationship between, how should we feel about profitability in a social enterprise? How should we perceive it to be?
Yes. So it took me a while to get to the level where I have to embrace it as an entrepreneur. I think because I came from the development sector, and technically we're still in the development sector, I was a very reluctant entrepreneur. So I had a very weird, distant relationship with like profit. But then I think through the years, because I used to do fundraising, when I embraced what entrepreneurship meant and how social entrepreneurship, how responsible profit is able to create impact in the work that we do, then I was very, 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 very determined that as a social entrepreneur, we're not going to rely on grants. We're going to establish a very strong business model that will actually be profitable for us to be independent and to be able to sustain the business and use our profits, reinvest it in the communities, in the programs that we facilitate in the communities. So if you're a social enterprise, or if you're wanting to become a social entrepreneur or establish a social enterprise, it's very, very important to be able to have profit, but to facilitate that in a responsible manner, because you're not able to care for the planet or the people if you do not have this first P. If you don't have profit, you're not able to sustain the business, nor are you able to actually create positive impact. And if you're not able to do both, then you're not a social enterprise.
Are you supposed to limit your profitability? I mean, sometimes I have to ask, like,
oh yeah,
profit ko, I can't make it go above or below, or help me understand if you don't mind.
I do not think you should. It doesn't make business sense for one to cap off their profit, right? So, like any other traditional business, you have to constantly aim high. Hindi mo naman pwedeng sabihin, okay, by next year, I'm not going to be able to grow already. Like, the 20% growth in my profit is enough. That's it. I'm just going to aim for that. I mean, that means that you're not actually also, you're limiting your capacity to grow within the context of social entrepreneurship. The mindset is, the more profit, the more you're able to actually scale your impact. So the more profit, the more positive impact you're able to create to your beneficiaries or to the partner communities you work with.
Really great. And you're right now commenting here on the page is Iba Rasul Bernardo. He is the guy behind PopWorks.
Hi, Iba.
Sorry. Hi, Iba. How are you doing?
And hi, Iba.
Says love local. So for people listening here right to the show, Iba is the same guy. PopWorks is also doing the app Sari, which is helping many of our Sari store mama, small store owners, especially the mamas out there and the titas out there, saying Antilla's beautifully crafted products. Thanks so much, Iba, for dropping by.
Thank you so much.
We're also going to be showing some of their websites later on and featuring some of their products here on the show. Having said that, no, I want to say hi also as well to the host. He's also the host of Two Niner Rider on the podcast network. So he's one of our hosts here also on Podcast Network Asia. So let's go back now. I like what you said, first of all, that as a social entrepreneur, you're still there to solve other people's problems, right? That's the basic entrepreneurial mindset. You're solving other people's problems. But yours is solving a social problem, right? So how do you identify what was that biggest problem that you wanted to solve? Because sorry, when you're in fundraising and development, chamber, and daming mga issues that you wanted, what brought you particularly to the issue that you wanted to solve?
I think you mentioned it earlier, a couple of things. Because back then, I think what really resonated with me is like the poverty of identity among young Filipinos. Like the traditional textiles were largely used for bed covers, linen, tableware, and they're only worn in special occasions. Linggo ng Wika, if you need to attend a conference and you're required to wear your traditional attire. And then we mistakenly call it costume, where in fact culture is not costume. And so wearing something na curtain or bed cover is perceived baduy or uncool. And I think I resonated with that. Like I wanted that to change because my mom would talk about these beautiful textiles and, you know, it was always a joy to wear them. And my thinking then is I want my future daughter and the future generations to still be able to wear this. And when I started immersing myself in these different communities, it was the same attitude even among younger weavers or younger women in the communities. They don't find the relevance of learning the craft. They don't see it as something that could put food on the table or something that they even call a profession. They themselves undervalue the craft. And it's so sad because they're taken advantage by a lot of middlemen and they're paid very low. And a lot of them, as you mentioned earlier, choose to like leave the countryside and go to the city, compromising family dynamics and everything. So all this kind of just piled up together. And I felt like women in the countryside, women in indigenous communities are not really given economic opportunities that they can own and that they can see as potentially something that could give them a brighter future.
So you identify the problem. How did you want to solve it now?
Yes. So initially we were brainstorming and thinking, so we have to show to everyone that people can actually wear weaves, that, you know, we can apply them in fun designs where people can wear it. Because we were thinking, what would make weavers weave the textile every day? If we're looking at sustainable livelihood, then it means that we have to increase their production capacity, their productivity. For more people to want to weave it, we have to increase the demand. And initially, we collaborated with young designers and applied the weaves in party wear. You know, kasi noon also yung gimmick, diba? Parang, okay, let's apply it in party wear. And then it didn't work. It failed, actually. Our first idea failed. It still is a special occasion. So we had to go back to the drawing board and think again, like, really understand the consumer insight, right? Like, if you're wanting for it to be of high demand, how do people shop? Where do they spend their money when they buy clothes? And we saw that a lot of women invest in clothes for work wear. So it's something that they have to wear every day. So that's kind of like the light bulb moment happened. So we then decided, okay, we're going to use these textiles, but in contemporary work wear, something that they can mix and match, wear to work, day to night. And then that's when it clicked, and that's when we were able to build a community or a movement of proud weave wearers, as we call it.
Right. And that's so really what I want to underscore by what you said is that it's really a process of iteration. Sometimes you've got, you want to solve a problem, but it takes several iterations until you actually get to what problem should, how to solve the problem in the most ideal fashion. Is that correct? Is that the correct understanding?
Yes, it doesn't happen in a snap. I mean, it's a process of really putting yourself in the shoes of your target customer, your target market, and then understanding, finding a match, finding a fit to your problem and to the needs of the customers, right?
And having said that, no, let's talk a bit more about business model, just because I think it's key for people to understand how Ant Hill actually makes money, because it's not something easily figured out. And just for people who need to understand business models, basically, how does the business make money, right? And how did you figure out what was the best business model that could work for Ant Hill? Maybe you can take us through what happened until you finally got to saying, okay, this is how it's going to make money and hopefully make money sustainably.
Yes. So the way we kind of figure that out is by experimenting on a lot of design. So it was a hit and miss also. And I don't know, I think all startups go through this phase where you kind of just keep on prototyping different products and see what would work in the market. So as I mentioned, for apparel, we were doing workwear, and this was initially targeted towards the retail customers, so business to consumers. And then as we were doing that, we also kind of explored and thought, oh, we could actually push this for uniforms. If we are looking at workwear, why can't we push the use of our fabrics for uniforms, for hotels, for offices, for teachers? So we were looking also at business-to-business channels. But for us to be able to kind of reach this market, reach both these revenue channels, B2B and B2C, the first point in our ecosystem model.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra.
Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Are the weavers or are the artisans, and we needed to build their capacity first because we can't be putting ourselves out there and creating demand if we're not able to really commit to the supply, right? So in our ecosystem model, at the core of it really is our artisans. And the reason why Antel was able to scale and serve these customers is we invested so much in building the capacity of the artisans, and we expanded and built relationships with so many weaving communities across the country. So from there, that's one stakeholder, one community. We then worked on having a network of designers. So design collaborators and designers, because that's not really our strength. We can't do everything, right? We can't do clothes, bags, accessories, everything to show how our weaves can be turned into finished goods. So our design collaborators are the second most important stakeholder also in the ecosystem model. And then third is we also ensure that these designs are brought to life. So we also have to work with mga seamstresses, bag makers, shoemakers. So that's also kind of the third stakeholder before it reaches our customers. So that's kind of how Antel works. From the raw material, from the textiles, from the weaving artisans, to the designers, to production partners, and then to the customer. So on top of us buying or procuring raw materials from these artisans, what sets Antel apart is we have a layer of relationship with these artisans, and we invest in what we call our community enterprise development program. So we help them become entrepreneurial too.
I like Ivan. See Ivan Handog saying over here, "You, the designs are so good." Thanks so much, Ivan, for chiming in.
Yay! Maraming salamat, Ivan.
Yeah. Thanks so much for sharing with us, Ivan. And aside from that one, what interests me right now is as you are building that ecosystem, what was fueling the operation? Because to me, right now, you're putting it together, but where was the money coming from? Were you bootstrapping? Bootstrapping meaning it was coming out of your own pocket. For those who don't know what bootstrapping means, it was coming out of your own pocket. Were you still working with a development mentality where you were getting grants? Because to build the ecosystem and to continue doing business while you're learning, it's like you're juggling two balls at the same time. How did you fund it as you were developing the ecosystem?
Yeah, so no, it was really hardcore bootstrapping. So the investment came from my mom and myself. And then the first few years were really working with a very lean but mean team. And we just got very lucky because we focused really on growing our business-to-business channels so that we're able to have a huge cash flow that we can roll. And I think what changed the course of Antel's business was when we worked with Bose Coffee. So Bose Coffee is our very first social procurement partner. Yeah, so Sir Steve is my mentor, and I also worked with Bose Coffee for a certain time. And when they rebranded Bose Coffee and wanted to expand to the rest of the country and even outside the country, he really wanted it to embrace its homegrown DNA. And we met and I pitched to him the value of social procurement and what it can create in terms of the ripple effect it has to our grassroots communities. And yeah, and then he just shared that vision and that value. And so in 2015, we dressed all of Boost Coffee stores when we did the renovation. So in their interiors, all the fabrics in their upholstery are from Ant Hill's community partners. And then their baristas wear a patch of scrap weave on their shirt and on their aprons now. So, and it was such a good partner to have because every time they grew and they opened the store, it also benefited Ant Hill and allowed us to keep growing our partner communities. And so that was like a very good example of a long-term partnership. And since that, we started looking for similar partners that could allow us to grow.
I know this is truly incredible, the story. And it takes a lot of persistence, I guess, to reach out to each of these weavers in different, because it's not, I guess you're Cebu-based, right? But you're not only representing Cebu-based weavers, you're representing weavers from, what are the different parts of the country which weavers you represent?
All over. So we work in Abra. So Ilocos, in the Ilocos region, we have in Abra and in Bigan. And then in the Cordillera region, we have about 4 communities. We also work in Mindoro. And then in the Visayas region, we have partners. And then in Negros. And then in Mindanao, we have in Bukidnon, in South Cotabato, in Basilan, in Maguindanao. So we're currently working with 20 partner communities. So yes, I think that's really the more challenging part of the business, I would say. It's working with the artisans.
That kind of stressed me out because I think, wow, she's the logistics here must be crazy. I have in mind, like, what is the logistics for this one work? Do you have a centralized warehouse to put together everything so that the designers can create a design which they can market? How exactly does it work?
Yeah, it took us a while to establish a system. But because of my background in community development, I think we're able to really build a very strong relationship and a very strong structure in the partner communities that we work with. So when we come into the community, we establish the leadership and governance structure of the enterprises that we work with. So the way Ant Hill works is we work with a community leader and then the community manager. So they are our point persons. So when we do our training programs, it's primarily focused on them, and then they train the rest of the artisans. It takes a while. It's a lot of time and energy and presence that you need to invest in these communities for you to be able to establish a good relationship. And in the past, we would do field visits every quarter just so we are able to establish a trust, just so they are able to understand supply chain standards. They're able to also value why it's important for them to professionalize.
Mm-hmm. Got that.
That took a lot of work.
How about, let's say, when the products are produced, how's the supply chain like? Do they send all the products to Cebu where you are? Is it centralized? Or is it out of,
yes,
they're out of their own places and they keep it there and then you just drop ship it to the client?
Yeah. So it varies depending on the needs. So usually we either give them the liberty to design and choose the colors. Second is we have like specific colors depending on market trends that we ask them to weave. Or third, if it's a corporate account, then the design and the colors come from the client. And then, yeah, so they ship it to Ant Hill and we manage the shipping or the production to finished goods before we ship them to the client. So that's kind of how the supply chain works. So it's a lot of overhead costs and logistics costs.
And basically the business model over here is when you sell the final product, the value add is the design and the marketing that gets shipped out. That's the sort of like the margins that you have over there. It comes from that one.
Yes. With our margins, the design puts a premium to the end product, but also the fabric itself is a premium product in itself, right? Because it takes so long for an artisan to actually finish a meter of textile. Mm-hmm. So that alone, people put value to it and they're willing to pay for it, especially when they're invested in understanding the process behind the product and invested in ensuring that the culture is, you know, preserved and sustained.
I see. And, you know, I was going to ask earlier on, and it just occurred to me, I mean, like in any entrepreneur, what you're doing was quite overwhelming, as I can see, because it was not just the fabric, it was, you know, the backward integrations you have to teach the community. You had put together funds, you had to put together clients. I'm sure there were instances that you also wanted to quit doing this one and say, I'm just going to do whatever my parents told me to do. I'm just going to do textile again. Did there ever come a point for you? You said, okay, wag na, masyado mahirap.
Oh yeah, I feel like that occurs to me every day, especially when it gets really exhausting. But I think I was so close to giving it up during the pandemic in 2021. I feel like because it was very tough, and I felt like there was so much decision fatigue because every small and big business affected so many people's lives, and at that time, I felt like I couldn't handle the pressure anymore. And I was so close to, yeah, to just saying, okay, like, you know, I'm going to quit. I think I've done my part here and I want to move on to something different. But yeah, I'm still here. We're still here.
Yeah. And like in the pandemic, what actually happens for many of us is that, you know, it was just another pain point that we had to solve. And actually sometimes out of desperation is an inspiration to do something different or something new, which actually changes the course of your business. That happened to us in Mercato. What happened to you and Antil? I know that the pandemic also gave you a new business model or a new perspective on the way to conduct Antil's business. Is that right?
Yes, we had to rethink the way we were working because I think we were banking on retail and retail distribution a lot the past years. And I think not that we lost track, but during the pandemic, no one was buying fabrics or clothes, right? So like, how do we reposition the business in a way where it will still be able to create impact in their communities? I think what was just very strong throughout the pandemic is we anchored ourselves back on our values and on our why, right? Like, why is Antil? And what is the value of our work? Why are we here? So what helped me personally was having conversations with our artisans and our partners. And I think just accepting the fact that we had very limited resources then and with the resources we have available, what can we do? How can we still create impact? And we had to put a pause to profit because obviously that's not something that, you know, was, I guess, feasible to make it happen at the time because it was just really a struggle. But we had to like keep the work going. And so the artisans expressed that they want to be able to weave tradition and technology. They don't want to be left behind. And everyone was becoming online sellers, but they couldn't sell in Shopee or in Lazada. And so they're looking for a platform where they can sell their fabrics. And so our biggest pivot during the pandemic was launching the very first online community fabric store. So we're the first online store in the Philippines that sells Filipino textiles. And it was amazing. It really gave such a huge sense of ownership among the artisans. They were so proud to see their beautiful fabrics on a website. And it worked. Like a lot of the diaspora community in the US, in Australia, in the UK, we're now buying fabrics because it's accessible and they are transforming it into different things.
And we're going to share that in just a bit. We're going to share the two websites of Antil over here, which I'm sure that the viewers and also the listeners can appreciate. But before that, one more thing. When you compare startups, again, and social enterprises to a startup, they have what you call venture capitalists, people who invest in the startup so they're able to scale. Now, when it comes to social enterprises, are you also on the lookout to secure equivalent sorts of venture capitalists to scale a social enterprise? Or do social enterprises look at it in a different way? They just use internal funds to grow the business and keep it at that pace?
Yeah, there are avenues where we're able to raise capital through VCs and impact investors also. In 2022, I attended an accelerator program at the Santa Clara Miller Center for Social Entrepreneurship. And this is what actually prepared us to, you know, prepare a pitch deck, prepare a portfolio, and be able to network with potential investors. And there are a lot of organizations, institutions that invest in social entrepreneurs or social enterprises. On top of profit, they do look at profit. They do look at scalability of the business, scalability of impact, but they also look at impact metrics. They look at how you're able to measure positive impact, and they want to make sure that, you know, your business model is effective in addressing the social issue you identified.
What exactly are sort of impact metrics so people can, especially those who are aspiring social entrepreneurs, can understand?
Right. So every social enterprise would have to have different impact metrics depending on what they want to address or where they want to create change. So, for example, for us, it's in terms of the income of the weaver. So we want to be able to increase the income of the weaver. So that's one metric we look at. If there is an increase in income, then there's also an increase in productivity. So we also look at increase in productivity, like what is their production capacity? Are they able to, you know, weave 1,000 meters per month right now versus 200 in the past? So we look at that as well, because that also determines scalability. We also look at the savings, so the level of savings of the artisans, because we have a financial literacy and savings program in Ant Hill. And then in the past years, we look at circularity. We've been very committed in our circularity programs also. So we look at how much income they earn from waste. And then we also look at how much kilos of waste we've upcycled. Mm. How much kilos of waste we've saved from getting into the dump site.
Have you brought in any impact investors so far? I'm sure there are some people who are looking at Ant Hill right now.
Oh, thank you. We've had quite a number of calls, and we were so close. We were actually on the round of going through a due diligence phase in 2020, but then sadly the pandemic happened. And then now we're on a recovery stage, so we're trying to hit our profit milestones again. And then if we're able to hit that, then we're going to be back in these calls. But it takes a while, and I think through the years I've also learned that, you know, and as much as it's important to scale your business so you can scale your impact, it doesn't necessarily mean profit. It could also mean growing internally. It could also mean scaling across and scaling in different ways.
Got that. Thank you so much for sharing with us, Anya. And right now, I want to share with the listeners and the viewers as well the two different websites which they actually came up with. What was the first one here, Anna? Is it Ant Hill Markets? Is that right?
Yes, Ant Hill Markets. So one of the interesting features in our markets is you can actually customize.
So this
you
is the
can
first
choose
website. To. This is the first website that
you yes.
Have. And yeah, so yeah, I'm sorry to step back, but tell us a bit more about it's antilmarkets.com. The purpose of the website is it's not just about us, right? Is it an e-commerce site?
Yes, it's an e-commerce site. So you'll see all of our ready-to-wear pieces, collaborations. We have for men, for women, for gifts. But when you go to the shop page also, there's a custom link. So for those who want to have something made to measure, or if they have a design in mind, they can actually just plug in their measurements on the custom page. We also have a video tutorial of how you're able to take your measurements yourself. And we do that quite a lot. We do a lot of made-to-measure orders. But on top of that, there's a lot of ready-to-wear available also. In fact, we're gearing up for one of the biggest fairs in the Philippines, which is Artifino, coming up towards the end of the month. So I hope you don't mind me plugging and promoting that.
Yes.
So we're going to be at the 5th Rockwell on August 24th. more until the 27th with over 150 brands of different Filipino local brands really pushing for local craftsmanship. So from accessories, clothing, furniture, everything under the sun, really. And you'll get the chance to try on the clothes and get the feel of the fabrics and, yeah, put a weave in your closet. So, Bayanihan, this one is a recent collaboration with Spark Project, which is a crowdfunding platform in the Philippines. This was a grant. This was a program funded by the Australian Awards. We just, again, going back to the artisans expressing how they want to weave tradition and technology. We supported the different artisans in pursuing alternative forms of livelihood. And yeah, we closed this campaign last month, and they're able to raise funds for their businesses. So we're just helping more.
I guess this is
grow different businesses and become more entrepreneurial. Yes, with Batch, correct. Yeah.
Not that. What are the other interesting highlights that you want to bring about, that you want to share with us about the page?
Here, this one, if you check with Collaborate With Us, it shows the different business-to-business partners that we've had through the years. So the banner above shows the upholstery of what we've done with Bose Coffee. If you can go up. So these are actually their lounge chairs. And they're all upholstered with Antel fabric. So we're able to do that. We're able to become your textile supplier. We also serve a lot of hospitality partners. So recently, we did the uniforms for Ascot Makati. These ones are aprons for a cafe in Brisbane, Australia. We do a lot of, yeah. So we've done a couple of aprons. Another one is for a bar in LA. We do work a lot with the diaspora community. We've been getting a lot of support from brands in the US, Australia, and in the UK. So, yeah, we also feature our zero waste partnerships. There's, for example, like Atmosphere Resorts in Dumaguete used our zero waste fabrics for their pillowcases. We also collaborated in the past with Bio, and we upcycled older textile waste and we re-wove them into new fabrics, which they used in their designs.
Very nice. So this anthillmarkets.com, for those who want to be able to support our local artisans or get their custom-made support and develop customized clothes for yourself or get RTW, you can drop by anthillmarkets.com. But you also have anthillfabrics.com.
Yes.
Switch over to anthillfabrics.com. Now, this is the website that you developed in the midst of the pandemic, right? Referring back to your discussion in the earlier portion of this podcast. Tell us a bit more about anthillfabrics.com.
Correct. So with Antel Fabrics, it's just really a fabric store. So we want to grow our fabric market among designers, among interior designers, fashion designers, those who are into crafts or textile collectors or hobbyists. So in this website, if you go to the shop page, all our fabrics are categorized per region. So you see Luzon weaves, Visayas weaves, everything. And we do video consultations for those who want to learn more about our textiles and how and where to use them. During the pandemic, actually, Jollibee Europe used our fabrics and found our site, found Antel Fabrics. And used our fabrics for the Jollibee stores, for the tables in the Jollibee stores. So we offer a lot of craft kits also. We're doing a workshop, online workshops on how you can learn how to weave. But what also is very unique with Antel is we can do customized fabric. So if there's a particular brand who wants to have a certain pattern in their brand colors, we can do that as well.
I want to show
and
this to
we sell our swatch books also.
Yeah, I was saying because like Mercato Central is supposed to represent, you know, Filipino street food, and we may be.
Yeah, your uniform, your aprons should have Antel weaves.
Antel weaves, or maybe from the tabletops or whatever else that we can put Now it's giving some ideas. Hopefully it's giving some ideas to the other entrepreneurs in the F&B or hospitality space where they can actually use some of these fashions in their own stores. You know, I'm surprised we're close to an hour and it's been a very very interesting discussion. No? But then, can I just ask you very briefly in the social enterprise space, especially the one that you're in, are there other opportunities that you're seeing for more social entrepreneurs to enter? Opportunities there that you've seen, but you're not particularly going to take advantage of because you're busy with Adtil. Are there spaces that you see that this is great for social enterprise, for social entrepreneurs who got the time and the passion to do this?
I think we're never going to run out of social issues, especially in this country. So there is a lot to solve. Particularly, I think we need more social entrepreneurs so we can push for social procurement to become a law. People always have a misconception. If you're a social entrepreneur, if you're a social enterprise, you're not going to be able to grow, or you're not going to be able to scale or to get good profit or get good income. But on the contrary, if we're able to push for social procurement, imagine all the private and public offices allotting budgets to reinvest in social enterprises. Instead of buying from China, like corporate giveaways, uniforms, and whatnot, and investing that in social enterprises. So there is a market out there. There are a lot of opportunities out there. And there's a lot of social issues we can still creatively solve, not necessarily in the fashion sector. It could be in the food sector. It could be in the environment. It could be in, any other space. So yeah, there are definitely a lot of opportunities out there.
Got that. And just to be clear, what do you mean by social procurement?
Right. It's a jargon I threw out. So, for example, private organizations and public institutions, like government offices, for example, they do have procurement requirements. So, right, they have office supplies, or they need office supplies, or they need corporate giveaways, they need uniforms. Even private institutions, let's say hotels, resorts, or FMCGs, they do have needs for volume procurement. And most of these, like gift packs or VIP gifts, whatever. And in the past, like a lot of these requirements are invested in buying from China, for example. They buy all those coffee mugs for corporate giveaways, or umbrellas, or USB ports or keychains. A lot of these are outsourced outside the country. But if we're able to push for a social procurement bill, then this will actually require for businesses to invest in social enterprises and procure from social enterprises. And given this, we're reinvesting in the local economy and in the local communities.
Anya Lim of Adtil. Again, if you want to visit, if you want to help out and support our indigenous weavers, again, please visit AdtilMarkets.com and of course AdtilFabrics.com. They also have right now a fabric gallery, which has become a driving force for positive change in the lives of indigenous communities. We invite you to please support the growth of Adtil and our indigenous consumers. Again, this has been RJ Ledesma for the RJ Ledesma podcast. Guys, thanks so much. We will see you in the next RJ Ledesma podcast.
The opinions of podcast creators, hosts, and guests are not necessarily reflective of the official stance of the Pod Network Entertainment, its hosts, or other network programs. The content created by the people behind the podcast is personal and not meant to harm any religion, ethnicity, group, organization, company, or individual.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.